So my name is Greg Collins. I'm the director of the Center for Resilience at USAID, and I'll be moderating today. I think that this topic, the sort of notion of building in analytics around poverty dynamics, understanding risk in relation to poverty, and then the role that resilience, that set of capacities that allows households to manage through shocks, whether it's a drought, whether it's a health crisis within the household, is really, really powerful. And I think it's an important pivot for USAID. As many of you know, the resilience agenda in USAID was really born out of the drought emergencies in the Horn of Africa and the Sahel in 2011, 2012. And now we're pivoting. We're continuing on with that work in the dry lands, but we're pivoting to the broader relevance. And you'll see that come out very clearly in this work today. So thank you for the Bureau of Economic Growth, Education, Environment, and the Bureau for Food Security, who've partnered with the Center for Resilience to put together this event that's being co-run by Microlinks and AgriLinks. We've got a lot to cover. If we could pull up the agenda. We do have a lot to cover, given the richness of the research. However, we've also made time for questions to be asked throughout the day. It's not going to be lecture and questions. We're going to have time to have some interaction between audience and panelists and presenters. However, we are a lot of people, and we do want to give enough space for people online to ask questions as well. So the way we're going to handle the questions is people in person in the room, write your questions down as they arise, pass them to the center of the room, and event staff will collect them and we'll have them asked by some of the event staff. People online can enter questions into their chat box, and we'll also queue those up and have them asked as well. We're not going to get to all the questions. That's pretty clear given the timeline. We'll try to get it as many as possible, and then we'll keep those questions and provide answers after the fact. So we're going to start off with opening remarks by Eric Postel and Beth Dunford, who we're thrilled have joined us here today. We'll then move on to a presentation of the research findings by the ODI team that's seated here on stage. We'll follow that with a short break. It's 15 minutes from 11 o'clock to 11:15. We're going to be very strict on that and start right again at 11:15. And then follow with a panel discussion on policy and programming implications of the research, followed by brief closing remarks. The only other thing to say is this event is being recorded. You'll receive a link to the recording via email after the event. And then finally, if you haven't turned off your phones, this is a good chance to take 2 seconds and do so, so that you don't forever live in infamy of having interrupted the event. We are recording it. So now I'd like to introduce our first two speakers. First, we're going to have Eric Postel. Since May 2015, Eric served at USAID as both the Associate Administrator and the Assistant Administrator for the Bureau of Economic Growth, Education, and Environment. He also serves as the agency's coordinator for the Government-Wide Partnership for Growth Program, and the alternate director to the Millennium Challenge Corporation. He brings to these roles more than 25 years of private sector experience working in emerging markets. Then after Eric, we're going to hear from Beth Dunford. Beth is the assistant to the administrator for USAID's Bureau for Food Security, as well as the deputy coordinator for the development of Feed the Future, in which she coordinates the implementation of Feed the Future across the U.S. government. I should also mention Beth also co-chairs the Agency Resilience Leadership Council. Very pleased to have both of you here today, and with that, I'll hand over to Eric.
Good morning, everyone. Good morning in the room, and good morning to everybody online. I don't know if our ODI team is happy or disappointed that somehow we've managed to bring London-like weather, drizzles, to Washington today. But welcome to everybody. And thank you, Greg, for the introduction and for your leadership at the Center for Resilience. I and the rest of the agency's leadership are very pleased with the incredible work the Center's been doing since it's established. So thank you, and to you and your team. And I also want to thank Andrew Shepherd and his colleagues from the Overseas Development Institute, ODI, for the compelling research that they have carried out under our Leveraging Economic Opportunities project, ODI is world famous for very high quality work that we always pay attention to. And they are a very important player in thought leadership around the world on many different facets of development. And I'm very glad that the people who are doing this research, you know, well, it's a collaboration, as you heard, between a couple different bureaus and the Center for Resilience. And that's so much of development is across sectors. It's a team sport, and this kind of collaboration is very useful. And that's why I'm glad that Beth is here as well, who's a real tireless champion for the fight against global hunger and poverty. Before we hear from Andrew, I'd like to set the stage a bit and offer a few thoughts on the relevance of the findings that are going to be presented. At USAID, we are pleased to be part of an administration effort that's placed a strong emphasis on ending global poverty across the board, as witnessed by our mission statement. And while we are proud of the tremendous progress that the world has achieved on poverty reduction to date, we also recognize that the work is far from finished. In fact, looking at the geography of poverty, it might be that the hardest work is still ahead of us. As you know, a net, and we'll get to that, why that word net is important, a net of 1 billion people have lifted themselves out of poverty since 1990. But at the same token, and as the research shows, 1.7 billion are also at risk of falling back into it. That's almost a quarter of the world's population. And the rates at which households experience a temporary poverty escape vary across countries. For example, in Ethiopia, 60% of households who escaped poverty between 1990 and 2009 fell back into it during that same period at some point or another. So the question before us all today is, how do we build pathways for sustainable escapes from extreme poverty? If fewer people are falling back down, that actually the net number is obviously going to rise. So that's where this research comes in. And as I understand it, and we'll learn more, it suggests that to find a sustained solution to break the cycle of poverty, we need to especially focus on people living on $2 to $4 a day, that they are the ones who are especially facing that risk of falling back in. So to do that, obviously, we have to follow people's trajectories to understand what puts them to a test, identify the capacities that enable them to remain out of poverty, and find commonalities across what's working. Only by asking these kinds of questions, as ODI and USAID have been doing, and getting evidence-based answers, are we going to be able to make steady progress to tackle the chronic poverty, stop impoverishment, and sustain people's escapes from poverty. So here we are today to learn from the findings and to try to ensure that as we go forward at USAID and across the whole development community, that our proposed solutions are driven by the best available evidence. So I hope that you'll all learn from the case of study. I hope you'll have robust conversations about the data and think about the ramifications of the research to the overall set of work and activities that we're undertaking. Thank you all for being here. You all have many, many things to do, very busy schedules. So thank you for your interest in this topic and for your continued engagement with USAID. And on that note, I'll yield to the outstanding head of our Bureau for Food Security, Beth Dunford. Beth.
Well, thank you, Eric, and thank you all for being here today as we take a deep dive into the new research and consider the implication for each of our efforts. And as Greg mentioned, and also Eric, I head up the U.S. government's Feed the Future initiative, which is supported by the important work of the Center for Resilience. And so while I have you all here, I'm just going to have to do a little bit of bragging about Feed the Future, which I do a little bit. We work closely with our partners within USAID, across the interagency and beyond, with many of you here in the room, and we've really made a lot of progress since the initiative began. We're contributing to very promising results to reduce poverty in Ethiopia, Cambodia, Malawi, Ghana, Liberia, which is seeing reductions in poverty anywhere between 12 and 36% in the areas where Feed the Future is working. And we've seen also drops in child stunting in recent years, between 12 and 32% in Bangladesh, Rwanda, Cambodia, Ghana, Malawi, and Honduras. And so there's a lot of momentum around global food security efforts right now. And with this global commitment running throughout all of the SDGs, and really the U.S. government doubling down on food security with the passage of the Global Food Security Act, which codifies into law what we're doing, we're in a really good place right now to begin to plan just what needs to be done in the next 5 years and also the next 15 years going forward on food security. And we're one of the things that's really become clear in this planning effort, what we've learned over the last few years, is that resilience needs to be front and center in what we do. This information that's going to be presented today is really going to help us understand and refine why resilience is so important and how we incorporate that in what we do. We know that the world is becoming increasingly complex and risks are intensifying, and this is not just in areas that are prone to drought, and it's not just about drought. Climate change is important, of course, but also price shocks, conflict, health risks, large health risks, individual health risks, are all have the potential to tamp down the important gains that we are making through Feed the Future. So what we're learning, what we know, is that escaping poverty is not a one-way street. Shocks and stresses that are associated with these risks that I just mentioned are causing households to be very much in danger and fall back into poverty at alarming rates. So we have to get better at understanding, building the capacity of people to really households and communities and also systems to mitigate, adapt to, and recover from shocks and stresses. And in short, what that means is we have to build and strengthen resilience, which I think is why we're all here today. So results from our resilience zones and also our Feed the Future zones show that the influence that by focusing on making people and communities more resilient, we will achieve our goals of reducing hunger and poverty. So this is true across the board. We have to focus resilience across all the areas that we work. It's not just a drought issue. It's not just an Africa issue. It's really in everywhere we work in order to achieve our goals of ending hunger, poverty, and malnutrition. So it means that we have to not just focus on humanitarian emergencies, that we need to make long-term investments that help people, communities, and countries manage adversity and manage change without compromising their future well-being. So we'll see today that we have a lot more to learn. I'm really excited to take these learnings into what we do with Feed the Future moving forward, and we'll turn it over to the presenters then. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you, Eric and Beth. I think their presence here this morning speaks to the extent to which this research has gotten very high attention. I think that in the way that Eric explained it, much of the work on poverty reduction that lies ahead could be the toughest work on poverty reduction that we've done thus far, in part because it requires that we grapple with the phenomena of transitory poverty escapes that we're going to be discussing today. With that, we're going to move into a presentation by the Overseas Development Institute, who, in conjunction with USAID's Leveraging Economic Opportunities Project, carried out this research. And I do recall being on a plane reading the 2014-2015 Chronic Poverty Report. There's copies in the back. And seeing these rates of backsliding and impoverishment, or people who are falling back into poverty or becoming poor for the first time, and having this aha moment that this is why resilience is so important for everything we're doing in development, and particularly for poverty reduction. People had said that in a general sense for a long time, but making it tangible, making it real, really required diving into data and showing what are the capacities that prevent certain households from falling back into poverty when other households fall back. So I'm super excited about the research, and we'll move into that now. So let me briefly introduce our presenters. We've got Andrew Shepherd, who's the director of the Chronic Poverty Advisory Network at ODI. He's now led the production of 3 chronic poverty reports and also contributed to EFAD's 2011 Rural Poverty Report. Lucy Scott is a research fellow with ODI's Social Protection Program and Chronic Poverty Advisory Network. She's co-authored several reports dealing with chronic poverty and labor, and her work focuses on livelihood and social protection approaches to reach and help the poorest households. Finally, we have Vidya Diwakar, who's a research officer in the Chronic Poverty Advisory Network at ODI. She's an econometric researcher and a policy analyst whose work focuses on investigating household-level poverty dynamics. Vidya also did a lot of the statistical analysis that informs this work, and we really wanted to have her here in case there's any thorny methodological questions that come up. So with that, I'm going to hand over to Andrew and to Lucy. Okay, great.
Great. Well, thanks, Greg. Thanks for having us here. It's a great opportunity to share with you the research which we've conducted and hopefully to have really interesting discussion around the findings. As kind of has been explained, we're here to present highlights from some of the research which we've been conducting, specifically in Bangladesh, Ethiopia, and Uganda. So just a quick outline to the presentation. So first, we're just going to introduce to you the study and its objectives. We'll then give some of the key takeaways from the research, so hopefully you can keep those in your mind as we're going through the more detailed findings. Then we'll give a quick introduction to the poverty success stories in each of the 3 country case studies, and give details then after that on the poverty dynamics trajectories which have been taking place in those countries. And then we'll go into more detail about the research findings before introducing some of the exploratory work which we've been undertaking using multidimensional forms of poverty. And then we will be concluding. Great. So an introduction to the study. So how did this work come about? Greg's already kind of given quite a good flavor of this. This is a graph from the most recent chronic poverty report. And it shows what subsequently happens to households after they escape poverty. So in particular, the grey bar shows those households which, after they've escaped poverty, have then returned again to living into poverty. So their escapes from poverty haven't been sustained over time. The yellow bar then shows those households which, after escaping poverty, have managed to remain successfully living out of poverty over time. So the graph kind of reveals that in certain contexts and over certain periods of time, households escape poverty and re-enter it. I should say here that the main point to illustrate is that one, that some escapes are transitory. The data presented here isn't nationally representative in all cases. It uses national poverty lines, but it's just to give a flavour that escapes are not always sustained over time. So this research is essentially concerned with why some households are able to escape poverty and remain out of it, while others escape poverty and then fall back into it. I think I might be pointing in the wrong direction. So this life history diagram gives a flavour of a transitory escape from poverty. So this household in Uganda, they were able to escape out of poverty, in this case through land, fishing, moving into coffee production. But then, since there was coffee wilt disease in this instance, they slipped back into poverty. This was followed by an ill health shock which compounded the impacts of the coffee disease and then fell back into poverty. So how does this link to resilience? So we're using resilience as that set of capacities that would have meant that in this instance, this household, following the coffee disease, following the ill health shock, was actually able to manage in the face of those shocks and would be able to stay out of poverty over time. So a flavour of what these research methods involved. So for each of the 3 case study countries, so for Bangladesh, for Ethiopia, and for Uganda, we started off by analysing 3 or 4 wave panel data. So panel data is data or household surveys which return to the same surveys at more than one point in time. So you can see the condition of a household at 3 separate points in time. So for Uganda, this data was actually nationally representative and had 4 waves. For Bangladesh and Ethiopia, the panel data set is rural and not entirely representative of rural areas. So it was essentially this availability of panel data along with Feed the Future interest countries, which kind of determined the focus countries for this research. So following analysis of the panel data, we then purposely selected sites in each country where there was a high degree of transitory poverty escape and a high degree of sustained poverty escape. So we specifically selected those sites where those poverty trajectories were quite prominent. And we then visited those research sites, normally, say, three sites in each country, three or four in each country. And we conducted participatory wealth ranking at 3 points in time, so we could determine household trajectories over the last 10 years. So what was your situation 10 years ago, 5 years ago, and today? And then in the focus group discussion, we discussed at the community and more macro level the drivers of escape, the drivers of descent as well. And then we actually specifically went to individuals in households, which are identified as transitory escapers or sustained escapers, and we conducted qualitative life histories with those individuals. And qualitative life histories is a form of open-ended interviewing. You're essentially looking over people's life course, you're discussing with them the events which have happened over their life, any ascents out of poverty, movements into poverty, and what did they feel were the factors which were driving that, or what enabled them to go through certain shocks without seeing a decline in their situation. So also just to make, there is a methods note that's been published for people who are more interested in details of the methodology behind the study. So key takeaways, so you're going to probably hear these messages quite a few times today. The first one is that poverty is not a one-way street. As some people escape poverty, others are falling into poverty, yet others who have escaped poverty are falling back into poverty. Poverty isn't a static phenomenon for particular individuals and particular households. The second key takeaway is that sources of resilience, or those capacities, if you like, to have a sustained escape, can be investigated through looking at why some households escape poverty and remain out of it, while other households escape poverty and fall back into it. In other words, they experience a transitory poverty escape. Sources of resilience include household characteristics, such as resources. These could include livestock, land, the value of productive or durable assets, activities, which could include engagement in the non-farm economy, and also household attributes, such as household size and education of the household head. But at the same time, it's important to remember that households are operating within certain contexts. It can't just all be down to an individual household to sustain their escape from poverty. And in particular, shocks, whether health shocks, or flooding, as well as systemic stresses, or stresses which are changing over time, such as land degradation or increasing climate variability, can reduce the likelihood of poverty escapes being sustained. They thought it would be useful just quickly to introduce the three-country context where this research was undertaken. I'm probably going to go relatively quickly since I'm sure quite a bit of it is familiar with you. The main point to make is that these three countries have been phenomenally successful at reducing poverty since the early 1990s. So this is Bangladesh. So the blue line gives the numbers of people in poverty or extreme poverty, which is then the red line, and the bars give the proportion of the population living in poverty is the blue bars, and in extreme poverty is the red bars. So basically it shows Bangladesh is been enormously successful both at reducing the number of people living in poverty and extreme poverty and also those proportions. This is monetary poverty measured using national poverty lines. Some of the main drivers in Bangladesh include the Green Revolution in agriculture, investments in rural infrastructure, also economic structural reforms enabling the growth of the ready-made garments sector. Migration is another key driver, both international and internal, which in turn has been contributed to increase in wages in rural areas, also a decline in fertility rate has further strengthened the labour market, and then there's obviously the NGO engagement as well as the government in human capital promotion, which is also argued to have improved women's empowerment in the country. So it's a very kind of holistic success story measured in this way. The second country context is Ethiopia. Again, Ethiopia has seen recent strides in the reduction of poverty. The proportion of people living in poverty has declined from 44% to 30% between 2000 and 2011. Key drivers here include inclusive economic growth, particularly growth in the agricultural sector. And the majority of poverty reduction since the late 1990s is explained by poverty reduction among rural, self-employed agricultural households. Expansions in the rural road network have again been very important in explaining the poverty reduction success. A second key driver is large public investments in social programs, including the Productive Safety Net program, which we'll hear a little bit more about later, impressive expansions in primary education. The third country context is Uganda. Again, as with Bangladesh, the proportion of the population living in monetary poverty using national poverty lines has halved since the early 1990s. That is the blue line in the graph, the going downwards line. Uganda is slightly different because due to population growth, the same degree of success hasn't been experienced in terms of reducing the absolute numbers of people living in poverty, which are the blue bars there, though there's still been a reduction in the numbers. Again, poverty reduction in Uganda is attributed to high and sustained economic growth, has been supported by macroeconomic stability, a post-conflict rebound, and pro-market reforms. Agricultural incomes and economic diversification for rural households have again been key drivers of poverty reduction. An interesting kind of side note in Uganda is that as poverty has reduced, so the insecure non-poor have increased, which is those people defined in Ugandan terms as living above the national poverty line, but less than twice the level of the national poverty line. So they are potentially quite vulnerable to falling into poverty in the future. And that's the red line and red bars in that graph. So the point of introducing the country context to stress how successful they have been, is to then show that despite the aggregate success in terms of reducing numbers of people in poverty and also the poverty headcount, there's still a lot of poverty dynamics going on within those countries, and in particular, transitory escapes, which is the focus of today's work, are prevalent there. So these pie charts show the different poverty trajectories of households, which were present in all waves of the panel surveys which we analysed for this work. So for Uganda, this is national survey data. For Bangladesh and Ethiopia, it covers just rural areas. But the yellow sections show how, despite the national progress at reducing poverty, some households remain trapped in poverty over the period. So they're what we call the chronically poor. They haven't been able to escape poverty at all over the survey rounds. But at the same time, there's other households which lived out of poverty in the first wave of the panel. They fell into poverty over the panel periods, and they've remained in poverty. So those are the black impoverished households in the pie chart. Then there's also another poverty trajectory, which is the churners, or the dark grey segment, the third one and from the left. Those households have just fluctuated around the poverty line in the period. So they've managed to improve their situation a bit, but have fallen back, maybe improved it a bit again. Transitory escapers, which is the focus of today's presentation, are the red segment. So these households lived in poverty in wave one, escaped poverty, and then were falling back into poverty by the last wave. So across each of the three countries, transitory escapers are roughly 10% of the survey population, and in Ethiopia they're highest at 15%. The navy segment to the right is then sustained escapers. Bangladesh, of the case studies, these are the highest at 41% of households. And in rural Ethiopia, they comprise just 6% of households. And then, as would be expected in each country, there's a proportion of households which remain out of poverty over the panel period, the light grey segment, and then a kind of other category for the different poverty dynamics trajectories, which is the white segment. So the findings, what are the sources of resilience which we found? Why are some households able to sustain their escapes out of poverty over time, while others aren't? So the first point is that resources are important. So across the three country case studies, high levels of per capita expenditure, a higher value of productive assets and consumer durables, and a greater number of livestock all increased the likelihood that escape from poverty will be sustained over time. So these findings are from both the quantitative and the qualitative data. So why might these be important to sustaining escapes? So intuitively, the finding on per capita expenditure makes sense. In other words, the further your level is above the poverty line, if you like, the less likely you are to return to living below it in the future. The productive assets and consumer durables, again, these could partly be a reflection of household incomes and expenditures. These assets can both either help to further household income, so for instance, say an irrigation pump or a bicycle could be productive in itself, or they can represent, say, stores of wealth which could be sold to manage a crisis. Jewelry, for instance, is included in the productive asset value, or the asset value, which could be something which people sell off in times of crisis. Also, across the case studies, livestock plays several important roles in supporting sustained escapes. So one role livestock can play is through livestock ladders, where households upgrade from rearing small ruminants, goats, sheep, to kind of selling them, trading them, and ending up with cattle, improving their futures in that way. Another is using livestock as a form of insurance, particularly goats and sheep are often sold to manage in crises. You don't feel it's necessarily drawing down your wealth too much, but it represents something which you can sell in order to get ready cash. Another is cattle fattening and trading business, which is illustrated by this life history extract from Bangladesh, where he points out how cattle, if you rear it correctly, can increase in value quite quickly if you sell it at certain times of the year, buy it at other certain times when the prices are low. So that's a shared finding. So in terms of resources, the main non-shared finding is around cultivable land, ownership of cultivable land in particular. So this is associated with sustained poverty escapes in Bangladesh and Uganda, but not actually with sustained poverty escapes in Ethiopia. So the life history from Ethiopia tries to illustrate this point a bit more about why land ownership in and of itself may not be sufficient to sustain escapes from poverty. In particular, this life history extract shows that the difficulties in accessing inputs are really quite a constraint in terms of being able to use the land to sustain your escape from poverty. There's also the issue of the vulnerability of rain-fed farming in context of increasing climatic variability, which emerge as well. So another set of findings following resources is around activities. So what activities, in this instance, is the household head engaged in? A shared finding across the three-country case studies is that if a household head emerges in economic activities, so as opposed to being too old or sick to work, say being retired or being a student, this increases the likelihood of a sustained poverty escape as compared to an escape from poverty, which is transitory, which is kind of makes a lot of sense. Salaried work is one of the most important activities in terms of sustaining escapes. But this isn't necessarily kind of a golden bullet, if you like. Obviously, the quality of the job is important as well. So as the life history extract here shows, Ishwar, despite having his job as an intercity bus security guard, he's still having to kind of combine this with other activities on the side as well. From a job, perhaps your income still isn't sufficient, if you like, to be able to sustain those escapes. In Uganda, several stories emerged of people actually leaving actual salary jobs because wages, say, were not keeping up with the cost of living, so they were going back to farming. A more surprising finding from across the country case studies is that the more economic activities a household pursues, controlling for household size, means that the household is actually less likely to experience a sustained escape. So on the previous slide, the life history extract showed how pursuing a few more economic activities, so say petty trading alongside working as the security guard, helped to sustain the escapes. But actually it appears that if you go to and get engaged in too many activities, there's kind of a cutoff almost beyond which you're not getting the advantages of specializing in a few activities. So up to a point, engaging in more activities can be positive. Beyond a certain point, it may actually be you're just diversifying for a coping strategy rather than actually being able to use that to sustain your escape. Another point around activities is about the non-farm economy and engagement in the non-farm economy. So if the household head is engaged in non-farm economic activities, then this is they're more likely to experience a sustained escape than if the household head is engaged in farming or agricultural activities as their primary occupation. So why might this be the case? In particular, the idea is to diversify your risk factors beyond agriculture. So you're not just the other activities which you're engaging in are not subject to the same risks as agriculture. So say they may not be as vulnerable to climatic risks as agriculture is, for instance. In reality, though, from the qualitative work, many of the non-farm enterprises which we came across were actually linked to the agricultural sector. So trading in crops, for instance. And the viability of many non-farm enterprises does actually depend on people's spending power in rural areas. So, well, ideally, you want to try and unlink your risk factors. Due to the dependence of rural areas on agriculture, it's quite difficult actually for that to happen in practice. So the life history research showed that non-farm enterprises were less the driver of sustained poverty escapes than having a job in the non-farm sector. They also revealed that households tended not to engage solely in non-farm activities, but did this in addition to agricultural activities. So say working as an own account farmer or an agricultural day labourer in addition to doing your non-farm work. A surprising finding about the non-farm economy from Uganda is that the data analysis revealed that female-headed households where the head was primarily engaged in non-farm enterprises were actually significantly less likely to experience a sustained poverty escape. One reason for this could be because of a lack of access to capital for women to engage in more high investment enterprises. So potentially instead they could be trapped in low productivity enterprises as the kind of life history extract from Linda here shows. She's stuck in kind of food cooking, not very high investment enterprises, and she can't really make that jump into a more capital intensive and potentially productive, though also more risky, non-farm activity. Another area we looked at are transfers. In particular, we looked at remittances. And so remittances, the kind of cash which people who've migrated away from the household send back to the household which they came from, they're an important source of resilience, particularly for female-headed households in Uganda and Bangladesh, but not the case for male-headed households. So this could perhaps reflect the fact that migration in male-headed households is more short-term. It's for households to cope, say, with a seasonal low in labour, rather than the objective being for the man, say, to migrate for a longer term with the aim, say, internationally of bringing in significant wealth for that household. In Ethiopia, neither internal nor international migration emerged from the data analysis or the qualitative work as a significant strategy. Another point is that positive strategies can go wrong. This is probably a bit obvious, but I think it's worth kind of stating here. So this includes taking a loan for productive purposes. It could be that the enterprise, the investment option actually fails, or say you cultivate high-value crops, you make a big investment in cultivating those crops, which are then wiped out by disease. So that was what we saw earlier in the life history diagram. And also in Bangladesh, there emerged two additional kind of drivers of escape from poverty being transitory. And this has involved people making upfront payments to engage in international migration where the job actually fell through, or making the upfront payments needed to access a salaried job, which again didn't come through. So households had actively tried to pursue positive strategies, but something had gone wrong and they just weren't able to either undertake that strategy or the strategy did not enable them to experience a sustained escape. So before we move on to the next part of the presentation, we thought it would be useful to open the floor up now for some questions. If anything's been unclear as I've been going through or something emerges as particularly interesting, and then we'll be moving on more to household attributes and the conclusions later on.
Great. So reminder, if you're in the room, please write your question down and pass it to the end of the row. We have people going up and down to collect them. And we'll start with some questions from the webinar.
So we have a question from Stephen Grafe and Ezgi Ukaner. They have to do with insurance and financial services. So the question is, did the study look into the ability of financial services to shield customers from shocks? If it did look into financial services, did they see a higher impact? And we also had a related question on health insurance. So if you could speak to the role of health insurance in protecting against transitory escapes.
Sorry, are we pooling the questions?
Do you want to take a number of questions and pool them and we respond, or do you want us to go one by one? Okay. Go ahead.
We have quite a few, so that's fine. We have a couple questions from around trauma and extreme poverty. They're from Dorothy Douglas Taft and Margie Brand. The essence of the question is, extreme poverty is recognized as trauma-inducing. Did the study determine if trauma care as a part of economic development made any notable positive impacts on resilience? And I'll give one more. So three, and a question from Amadou Kamara. Why was land not a source of escape in Ethiopia?
Great. So starting with the last question first, land in rural Ethiopia. So cultivable land ownership per se in Ethiopia didn't emerge as a factor which sustained poverty escape. The reasons which the qualitative work uncovered, if you like, for this, was one reason was because of a lack of access to high-quality, high-yield inputs. So people were more in traps whereby they were cultivating low-quality, say, non-hybrid varieties of crops, so that wasn't sufficient to produce enough either for consumption or for sale to sustain an escape from poverty. In addition, in context of rain-fed agriculture, so there's limited irrigation, in particular with climatic variability, kind of shifting of seasons, then it becomes much more difficult to have high levels of production. Around health insurance, which is a really interesting question, we didn't actually come across anybody who had any health insurance certly in the qualitative work. In the panel surveys, I'll let Vidya maybe answer a bit more detail, but it wasn't as significant. There were just not enough people who had health insurance to be able to do any analysis on that at all. I personally think health insurance would be really important, but yeah, there just isn't the findings out there to show that. So in terms of wider financial services, Vidya is actually going to touch on this a little bit later in the presentation. Did look at credit in a way and the importance of kind of appropriate credit in sustaining escapes and how if that credit isn't appropriate can actually do the reverse of that. But Vidya will explain more detail later. I'll let Andrew answer on trauma, I think.
Well, I'm not aware that the study produced anything about the impact of trauma care. It's not something that we specifically looked at, but I think it is, it's potentially something that one might want to go forwards to look at in some way, but I think you'd need to design a specific study to do that around one of your programs, if you have programs working on trauma care. I think it's just worth saying on health insurance that this will come up in the second panel this morning.
Okay, thank you. Three questions from in the room. Has the study looked into the application of the rule of law related to generational asset accumulation and inheritance to help escape poverty? And from Bronwyn Irwin at IRG, and please feel free to write your name, did the study look specifically at women's empowerment and the impact on sustainable escape from poverty? And with regard to livestock as a driver of sustained escapes, can't it also be a risk if the household stores too much of its wealth in livestock, which may die or lose value in a drought? Did you find that a certain percentage of household assets stored as cash, such as a savings account, was important for resilience?
To quickly respond to the women's empowerment question, it's it's somewhat difficult to define empowerment in different contexts, and the definitions vary. But one way we did cover this is looking at the role of female headship and its effect on contributing to sustained poverty escapes, which we'll return to in the next set of slides.
Great, and yeah, just in on the livestock question, yeah, I think that is a very important point. The more you put all your eggs in one basket, if you like, yeah, the higher risk there are to the eggs in that basket. In the qualitative, we didn't actually come across anybody who had accumulated large numbers of livestock. If you like, more, it was a process whereby you're buying and selling livestock rather than kind of building up a large herd of livestock. But yes, that is important to remember to diversify to a certain extent, so to kind of help to avoid catastrophic losses.
And on inheritance, I don't think it's something that we've looked at for this study, but there was a previous set of studies. If you go to the Chronic Poverty Research Center website, you'll find a whole raft of studies on specifically on inheritance and on the application of inheritance laws. And I think there's a number of policy briefs there as well. So it was a topic that we researched in a bit of an earlier generation of work. And it certainly can be a very significant issue. But I would encourage the questioner to go back to that data source. I can't recall exactly what the highlights of that were.
Okay, one more question from online. This is from Sunil Rejmi. His question is, households in the study may have different poverty ladders. In your study, how was falling back to poverty trap different with different levels of poverty? In other words, households lying just below the poverty line and households which are deeper in poverty. How is it different by resilience capacity of the households?
And one last question from in the room for now. Can you please talk about sample size of the surveys, the panel data, as well as from the qualitative work, and how confident do you feel the findings are representative? Are there any limitations of the study that we should be aware of?
Yes, on sample size, the sample sizes varied across country contexts. Keep in mind that in Bangladesh and in Ethiopia, this is a rural survey, a rural panel. And in Bangladesh, the survey itself came from a questionnaire design, which was designed to target to assess the effect of certain interventions. That being said, it does characterize more generally the rural situation and agricultural conditions in rural Bangladesh. In terms of our samples of interest within the sample size, which ranged from around, I believe there was 1,193, for example, as a total sample in Bangladesh. But within that, we focused on the subsamples of transitory escapers, sustained escapers, and impoverished. So across country contexts, these figures, again, vary greatly. I'd encourage you to look at the reports on microlinks and other sources. But for example, there was around, in Ethiopia, this figure sticks out. It was the smallest number of sustained escapers. There were 51 such sustained escapers, but in Bangladesh, there was a much higher in the hundreds of households of sustained escapers.
Yeah, and if I just jump in there, so yes, the video is talking about the quantitative panel data analysis. In terms of the qualitative life history collection, there are about kind of 20 life histories undertaken in each country across three communities in each country. So it was about 5 to 8 life histories per community, 3 communities in the country. In terms of Bangladesh, we specifically went to Joshua District, which isn't a massively disaster-prone district. So that would definitely have implications for the representativeness, if you like, of this of the qualitative findings for across the country. So that's something to bear in mind there. But, I mean, that said, Joshua still gets regular annual flooding, as you do in Bangladesh. It's just less disaster-prone.
What about that question about falling back into poverty from different levels? Is that something
right.
that you've...
So, yes, we looked at that descriptively in Bangladesh. So we've actually found that quite a significant number of households in Bangladesh started off in extreme poverty, then escaped poverty, but then again slid back into extreme poverty. So it wasn't necessarily that it was just they were tottering around the poverty line. It was from a significant increase followed by a significant decrease again. And also, just as a sort of robustness check, we've also looked at we've created a 5% band around the poverty line to distinguish transitory escapers from potential churners. And in Ethiopia, this revealed no differences in the number of households. So in all cases in Ethiopia and in most cases in the other two countries, it was the case where households were in fact significantly below or above the poverty line, suggesting that these were in fact transitory escapers as opposed to just churners.
Okay, and now we will hand it back to you guys to continue the presentation. For those in the room, feel free to write questions at any point and pass them to the end. We'll have people continuously looking for them. Thank you.
In the set of slides, I will begin by talking about household attributes, move on to household shocks, and then also consider some systemic drivers. So in terms of attributes, if you look at household education, the literature suggests that increasingly it recognizes education as a portable asset, one which is conducive to resilience even in post-conflict situations. And in fact, in our study, we find that a more educated household head is more conducive to that household experiencing a sustained escape. Disentangling this finding a bit, we see that, for example, in Bangladesh, it's not just education per se, but the level of education, which is also important. So, for example, a household head which has completed secondary education is more likely to experience a sustained escape relative to the primary education completion, and similarly, primary relative to no completion of education. And in Ethiopia, we see descriptively that there were very low secondary education rates of the household head. However, on a positive note, we have seen in the literature that there has been significant investments in education since the early 90s, which has narrowed the gap amongst the poorest, narrowed the gender gap, as well as the gap between Waredas, which are poorer, more remote, food insecure pastoral areas, and others. However, it's also worth keeping in mind in the sphere of education that we do see that improvements are not always uniform, either within or across countries. So, for example, in Uganda, qualitative research also highlighted considerable female-specific barriers frequently related to social norms, which girls face when trying to continue with or even complete education. So one of the life histories, or several rather, I'll point to one from Ruth. She was an individual in Uganda who we interviewed, and she went to school until primary two, so until second grade, and she enjoyed going to school. However, at that point, her father believed that it was a waste to keep spending money to send her to school, and so withdrew her from school. However, her brothers continued to attend and receive education. So in summary, even though we do note that education is a portable asset conducive to sustained escapes, we must also keep in mind that there are many obstacles and potential caveats to this. In terms of obstacles, one is family size and composition, as Ruth's story somewhat indicates, and we turn to this next. So then we ask, where is household size, what type of household composition is conducive to sustained escapes? In terms of household size, the results for the household size are shared. Specifically, our results indicate that a smaller household size is, in fact, more conducive to the household experiencing a sustained escape, but the shares of children and dependents do not indicate similar findings across countries. So, for example, a smaller share of children is beneficial in Ethiopia and Bangladesh, but not necessarily so in Uganda. Even so, our life histories in Uganda highlight how having a large number of children was often a driving factor in withdrawing them from school due to an inability often to afford school fees. And Daniel's story illustrates this. So, for example, Daniel went to school until senior four. However, starting of senior five, due to lack of money, his father had to withdraw him from school. His father had used his pension to educate children, but he had seven children, and so money became scarce. So then, in fact, while our life history interviews show that girls may be at more of a disadvantage in Uganda when it comes to education, stories such as Daniel's highlight that boys too suffer in situations of large households or with a large share of children.
And in fact, it's not just education expenses which may pose high costs of children to families. In other instances, girls may also exert a cost to families through wedding expenses. While our qualitative interviews found that dowry wasn't officially practiced in Bangladesh, for example, many families still continued to give gifts to the grooms and in situations of weddings. And Shafiqul's life history illustrates this. So around 4 years ago, he arranged the marriage of his only daughter, and to do so, he had to undertake several strategies to help pay for the wedding. So, for example, he sold a cow, he received gifts from relatives, took out a loan from BRAC, borrowed money from neighbors, from a moneylender, and so on. And, of course, though, this isn't to say that children are necessarily an unsustainable economic burden for a household. Rather, it's a combination of, one, the number of children, with, two, their timing with respect to a household's life cycle and income generation capacities, which influences poverty trajectories. For example, many of the life histories revealed instances where women felt that they had no choice but to give up working upon the birth of a child, as is the case of Charon in Ethiopia. So, for example, she was originally working in a state flower farm. She was earning actually more than her husband, but gave up her work upon the birth of a child because she believed that the long working hours were incompatible with child-rearing duties. And in fact, what we found in life histories and focus group discussions as well was that when children grow up, sometimes their mothers would seek to go back to work and oftentimes also bring their children with them. However, in these situations, they were likely to experience a drop in pay as a result. And so far in the analysis, it seems that there's actually little benefits in terms of poverty dynamics, at least, to female headship and to being a woman in a lot of these instances. So in our analysis, then, we also asked, where is female headship actually conducive to sustained poverty escapes? And our results have indicated that it is conducive in Bangladesh and Ethiopia, but not necessarily so in Uganda. And these findings should be contextualized accordingly. So, for example, in Bangladesh, we found that female headship is more likely to be conducive. And in the country, there tends to be two groups of female-headed households. One, where the male head has migrated, sometimes even internationally, and two, where a woman has been abandoned, divorced, or widowed. So while this latter group tend to be amongst the most poorest households in rural Bangladesh and thus have limited prospects for sustaining poverty escapes given limited income generation capacities accessible to women, the former group, that wherein the male has migrated, are some of the better-off households in rural areas due to oftentimes their receipt of remittances. And in fact, when we interacted remittance receipt with female headship, we still found that these households were more likely to experience a sustained escape. And then also beyond the reasons for, beyond this reason for becoming a female headship, we also see another benefit, one which comes from working in partnership, which could still exist in a designated female-headed household. And Rashida's family illustrates this. Her father and mother were both involved in, for example, cultivating land, weeding, renting out a relative's tractor, masonry, and raising cattle. So this was the case in Bangladesh. So moving to Ethiopia, we also see considerable differences exist by gender on a descriptive level. So for example, looking at one of them, we see that female-headed households tend to be smaller on average, consisting of around 4 members compared to almost 7 members in male-headed households. And one possible reason for this is that it could be the case that in a struggling female-headed household, only members who are not economically independent stay, whereas others move away. So, for example, male adults could leave in search of a job, daughters could be married off, other children could be sent to live with and work with families that could take care of them. These practices, however, may be less accentuated in male-headed households, wherein, especially if the household owns land, which would require, in turn, the manpower of other family members. So then we also asked, why then in Ethiopia, for example, are female-headed households more conducive to sustained escapes? We explored the literature a lot and developed, and life histories as well, and developed potential hypotheses for this. One potential rationale is that the survey data may be missing some sort of transfers or other interventions such as livelihood support, which aren't covered in the survey, but which prioritize female-headed households. So in this situation, these female-targeted interventions are not accounted for in the analysis, but could still explain then women's better poverty trajectories. Another example could be that women are frequently cited as being more risk-averse than men and often saving instead of investing in productive or potentially even riskier measures. And this then might provide them with an ability to withstand shocks which might otherwise drive them back into poverty. So in this slide, we also note that female-headed households are more likely to have a person with disability relative to male-headed households. But then we also asked, what's the effect of having a person with a disability itself on the likelihood of sustaining a poverty escape? So in our results, we found that households with persons with disability are more likely to experience a sustained escape in Bangladesh and Uganda, but not so in Ethiopia. However, again, we must, in exploring the effect of disability, we also need to consider several other factors, such as the policy environments. Do persons with disabilities face social and environmental barriers? What are the policy and programming responses to this? Do they receive assistance? We should also consider the interactions of disability with other factors, such as, for example, gender. So in Uganda, a caveat to the overall positive finding is that disability is still associated with an increased risk of transitory escape amongst female-headed households. And in Bangladesh, other research that we've been doing in CPAN indicates that amongst persistently poor women with disabilities, they tend to face systematic barriers, which ultimately mean that they have less access to to schooling, to labor force options, social transfers, and so on, which mean that compared to their male comparator group, and so which mean that policies and programs need to potentially develop then to target this triple intersection of women that are persistently poor and have a disability. And then beyond this, we also need to consider the definition of disability that we're employing. Is it a medical or social one? Also the strength of the disability. Are we looking at moderate or severe disabilities and so on, impairments and so on? And just to give a snippet of a life history on communicating how having an impairment might contribute to a higher risk of transitory escape or less options for sustaining a poverty escape. Ayana best describes this. So 6 years ago, she lost a leg and since then hasn't been able to work the lands, which as a result she has had to give away. And to exacerbate the situation, her children and community context factors itself has limited ability to support her, and as a result, she often has to beg for money. So far, we've seen a lot of attributes and examined which have contributed to sustained escapes and how. We've looked at education, household size and composition, female headship, and most recently, disability. We next move away from household attributes to look at household shocks. And across our case studies, we found that it's not necessarily the presence of one shock, but rather that of a succession of shocks, a series of shocks, which is an obstacle to a household experiencing a sustained escape. And this was a shared finding across countries. And disaggregating the shocks by the type of shock, we see that, for example, in Uganda and Ethiopia, there was a lot of climate and environmental-related shocks which tended to affect households. In fact, in Ethiopia, of the types of shocks covered in the survey, a rise in food prices coupled with drought constituted over a third of shocks affecting rural households in the country, whereas in Uganda, environmental shocks, again, across survey waves, affected around 40% of the sample. In Bangladesh, however, interestingly, it was an especially significant episode of illness for a primary income earner, or a series of smaller health shocks, or even health shocks, again, that occur in close succession to other types of shocks, which came up repeatedly in both quantitative and qualitative analysis. So an example of this would be the case of Rania. In Bangladesh, she experienced a series of health shocks. For example, her elder daughter had a uterus infection, then her son also fell ill and required clinical care, and then most recently, Rania itself has also been sick with diabetes and other pain. And to cope with this, a lot of times she's had to sell lands, she's had irregular payments coming in from her children, and also she's reduced her food consumption. And then, so beyond shocks then, we also see that sometimes shocks itself can trigger systemic processes of transitory escapes in otherwise upwardly mobile areas. In fact, in Ethiopia, a general lesson of the country is that drivers of poverty dynamics are systemic and they change as much as they are related to individual and household characteristics. Accordingly, when we analyze poverty dynamics, we need to account for household characteristics and how they interact with the context. So then looking at the context in Ethiopia, we see that there are many unresolved structural problems, problems such as insecure land rights, lack of access to financial services. In addition, there's limited rural to urban migration. Now, because of all of this, Ethiopia has a slow pace of structural transformation. So a slow pace of occupational change from agriculture or low productivity sectors to higher productivity sectors. This slow pace in turn then has meant that there's a limited size of a rural non-farm sector and that the creation of sufficient income generation opportunities for the poor in rural areas remains limited, or in fact does not take place in some instances. So given that rural households face these limited livelihood opportunities outside agriculture, this in turn constrains the strategies available to households to escape poverty and cope with shocks. Moreover, this is problematic in a context where agriculture is highly vulnerable to environmental shocks, as we saw from the last slide in Ethiopia. In fact, in such a highly agricultural dependent country with this incomplete structural transformation, we see that several factors can trigger system-wide processes of escapes from poverty that are transitory, even in contexts which had previously been characterized by growth and increased prosperity. So some of these factors could be repeated crop failures, shocks to agricultural production, land degradation, and other factors which challenge productivity. So exploring one of these elements, in turn, land degradation, for example, we see that in Ethiopia there's a combination of increasing pressures on an already degraded land base. And part of this stems from increase in population growth, which exists in a context of relatively limited family planning, which in turn has forced many families to make choices which potentially prevent their sustained escapes. So, for example, many families feel almost forced to continue marginal farming activities in a home village due to the absence of family support in towns to support larger families and household sizes. So ultimately then, when these processes occur, because the agriculture and economic activities are not increasing in tandem with increases in household demographic composition and size, or in keeping with broad increases in prosperity, these systemic factors in turn mean that recovering the household's initial position may be especially difficult and thus require even larger interventions. And while this was a spotlight on Ethiopia, it's worth mentioning as well that these systemic stressors also existed in terms of land issues in Uganda, as well as credit taps in Bangladesh, and high costs of marriage as well in Bangladesh. So ultimately, our analysis of these three case studies revealed that drivers of poverty dynamics vary according to country context and the level of analysis. Are we focusing on the macro, meso, or micro? So far, the drivers have generally relied on a monetary conception, monetary measure of poverty derived from comparing a poverty line off a national poverty line to per capita income or consumption expenditures. However, to account for these differences in poverty measurements, our team is also currently in the process of examining and measuring poverty multidimensionally as framed by the UN and OFI's Multidimensional Poverty Index. Now, I won't say too much on these findings, except to give a snippet of preliminary observations on how these two measures compare, specifically looking at the households, the sample of households that have experienced monetary poverty trajectories. We investigate whether these are the same households who are also multidimensionally poor. And interestingly, our answer is not always, and in fact, in some cases, rarely. So from these graphs, we actually see that across countries, the largest overlap in negative poverty trajectories, that is, impoverishment, transitory escapes, or chronic poverty, tends to exist in chronic poverty. This overlap also tends to be much stronger in Uganda and Ethiopia. And if you think about this, this tends to be intuitively sound, as it's likely that those individuals that are persistently or chronically poor, below the monetary poverty line, may also be unable to afford education costs, may be more susceptible to chronic illness, and live with less assets and other living standard variables typically associated with multidimensional deprivations. Whereas in Bangladesh, we don't see this to the same extent due possibly to the human development drive of the MDG era. So now I will hand over the floor to Andrew, who will give a summary and conclusions on what's been discussed. Thank you.
Okay, well, this has been a long presentation, and I bet you all thought that was the end, but no, there's another speaker. But I will be brief. I'm just going to try and conclude and set one or two issues for the second panel to deal with. The question here is, what does getting a sustained as opposed to a temporary escape from poverty entail? And I'll try and draw out a few leading issues from that. I think the point is that some households experience one, some households experience the other. We found that some sources of resilience are shared across countries and others are not. So how do we sort this? Those are the issues that I'm going to try briefly to conclude on. First of all, agriculture is clearly very important. Your Feed the Future program is very centrally placed. I think there are two observations to make here. One is that people making sustained escapes very often tend to be those who are able, for one reason or another, to develop market-oriented strategies, high-value crops. In some cases, they may regularly switch crops depending on market prices. We've heard an example about cattle fattening and cattle trading and so on. And also involvement in productive borrowing. We've heard cases where borrowing has been for consumption purposes. Sustained escapers are often able to use financial services for productive purposes. And I suppose the question is, in relation to poverty eradication, how can more farm households get into the position where these strategies become possible? And this is where the ladders and graduation strategies that we talk about are really pertinent. But you've also got the enabling factors of the development of the market, competitive markets, and infrastructure investment policies and programs in the background. So market-oriented strategies and making those possible, clearly very important. But also underpinning this, at least in certain environments, are strategies to counter land degradation. And the environmental sustainability comes out as a pretty important factor, certainly in Uganda and Ethiopia in this study. Secondly, we've seen that livestock and other assets are important. Just a couple of things to say there. Assets need protecting. I mean, clearly assets are there as savings, but they need protecting. Livestock need good veterinary services. There are very few low-income countries in which one could say that that is the case. There's another issue with livestock, which hasn't come out, I think, in the findings so far, but came out in the qualitative work, I think, particularly in Ethiopia, which is environmental sustainability. Accumulating livestock, yes, can be important, but are there limits to that? And I think in many local contexts, there may well be limits to that. So, you know, we need to perhaps think about livestock investments in the context of broader possibilities of investment in the rural non-farm economy going forwards. Quite a bit of emphasis in the presentation so far on small households. However, and hints about some of the dangers for some small households. You can be too small a household. So household division can be very disadvantageous. And it seems that, for example, women who become abandoned, divorced, may have very little by way of insurance to call on. Social networks may not be very supportive. Even families may not be very supportive in some of those situations. There are other issues bound up in the process of household division, which are also difficult, and we haven't really touched on them, but alcoholism and domestic violence, these are kind of things that come out sometimes in the qualitative research that we do. So these can also be significant risk factors. We've talked quite a bit about education. I don't think I need to repeat anything on that, but it is obviously a very important part of the mix. Coming to enterprise, I think again we've seen lots of examples of where developing enterprises are important. But there are some limits to this. If markets are not, okay, I think we're in good time, actually. Thank you. If markets are not functioning particularly well, or if they're becoming saturated, and we had an example of a female-headed household in Uganda, if markets are not particularly competitive, so the returns from markets are not great. We see this often in agriculture, I think, where there are just not enough buyers for the crops that people are producing. In the rural non-farm economy, the demand for products and services may be limited. As was pointed out, there's a critical growth role for agricultural growth here and the interaction between the two. But if you haven't got a decent process of agricultural growth going in a particular area, where do you go from there? So there are some dilemmas. I think the finding about specialization is an interesting one. And it may be that this is something that we should push on a little bit in further work. You know, how much specialization is advantageous? I think this question was posed. Obviously, where diversification is pushed, is compelled, if you like, by the situation as a coping strategy, then it's unlikely to lead to sustained escape. So I think pushing on that issue of specialization is something that we might want to do a little bit in future. There's a policy question here which arises around the findings that the suggestions that finding a job is actually more significant than moving into self-employment. I think as a development community, and by that I'm talking about international agencies, NGOs, but also governments, there's been quite a preference in many situations for promoting self-employment. And I wonder whether, you know, we perhaps need to think a little bit more carefully about the advantages and disadvantages of promoting small and medium-sized enterprises and creating employment as a poverty reduction strategy as opposed to self-employment. It's not that one has to outdo the other, but I think the emphasis has very much been on self-employment, and maybe we need to balance that up, just as we need to balance up support between agriculture and the non-farm economy. The emphasis has tended to be on agriculture. Perhaps we need a more balanced approach. The same in relation to job creation and self-employment. So we saw that migration could be really important. Not in Ethiopia. Perhaps the jobs are simply not there yet. Negotiating salary, jobs, remittances, particularly important for female-headed households. And even agricultural labor can be part of a sustained escape from poverty where real wages are increasing, which is the case across many countries in Asia. And this is the final point, on shocks and stressors. I think we've seen that there's a variety of different shocks in different situations, and what you probably need is a portfolio response. You need a suite of risk management measures. And I think a point that comes across very strongly, particularly out of Bangladesh, but also from the other two countries, is the importance of including the idiosyncratic shocks in developing policy and program responses. And I think I will stop there. Thank you very much.
Cheers. Okay, thank you, Andrew, Lucy, and Vidya. I think that was a very compelling presentation. And I think one thing I wanted to note before we go into the Q&A, which we have till about 11, to ask these questions either online through the chat pod or here through passing cards to the center row, is that this analysis looked at existing panel data from various data sources, and really dove deeply and milked that data for as much as it could get. But there's going to be a whole other set of questions that arise from this that can be better explored as we build out our primary data collection. So we heard mention about psychosocial issues in other resilience measurement work we're doing. We're building in measurements of aspiration, of people's own perceptions of their ability to cope with a major shock event. So some of this is going to demand that we begin to ask different sets of questions. I think the same thing around this issue around diversification versus specialization. I mean, I think the history of the world's fairly clear on where the role that specialization plays, at the same time, the ability to diversify risk by stepping a foot out into a different risk profile for livelihood seems to be important. But that demands we collect data in a different way. We can't just ask, do you have income from wage labor? We have to unpack the type of wage labor. So there's a whole set of data collection and analysis questions that arise from this, in addition to the rich findings that have already been sort of gleaned from going back to this data. So we will go to questions, and I think, Kristen, are you, Tiffany?
So let's start with four questions from online. The first is from Luseki Wasilwa. The question is, did you consider how communities cope to address issues of food security and income security in terms of influencing sustainable versus transitory poverty escapes? The second question, it's from Patty Pateski and Kristen Patterson. They both had kind of similar questions around gender and unpacking the gender findings a little bit. The first part of the question is, did you look at or consider how gendered influences on mobility influenced sustainable poverty escapes? Another version of kind of unpacking the gender findings is, did you look at influences of modern contraception, family planning, age of marriage, and age at first birth? The third question is unpacking education findings a little bit more. The question is from Kristen Maladiza and also Reneth Mano. The question is, did the study find out whether there were specific aspects of or qualities of education that influenced sustainable poverty escapes? So kind of if you could unpack the education findings a little bit more. And then finally, we have a question from Emily. We don't have a last name, but the question asks for a little more clarification around the shocks and stressors, and specifically whether the influence of shocks and stresses have to do with multiple shocks and stresses in a row or kind of worsening effects of one shock at a time.
Okay. On shocks and stressors, it was the survey module. First of all, it's worth noting that as well from survey data, there's limited information that can be gathered about shocks. So, for example, information around coping strategies might not always be present in, as well as the recall error might, the ability of households to recall shocks that come from periods further back might be, might cause the impact of the shock to be biased downwards as conveyed in the survey results. But in general, it was the presence of multiple shocks as opposed to a potential worsening that was actually analyzed. So it's the presence of multiple shocks that has that increases the risk of a transitory escape. And then on gender, which Lucy or Andrew will follow up on as well, qualitatively, we did see that the age of marriage as well did have an effect. So, for example, in Bangladesh, a lot of families tended to, the age of marriage was still young, so one of the life histories pointed to Shapna, I believe, who was married at just the age of 13, and a lot of times this is associated to the costs of marriage that tend to increase as daughters grow older, because in some instances then it's harder to find a husband, so it requires a higher gift in these situations. Lucy?
Yeah, I think just picking up on where Vidya left off there, also I think the age of marriage is associated with girls dropping out of school as well, and given the importance of education for sustaining escapes in that way, getting married younger for a girl is associated with a lower chance of experiencing a sustained escape. In terms of education, we haven't been able to unpack the qualities or aspects of education. I mean, from the literature, things which come out very clearly are the link between education and the labor market, ensuring that people are learning skills at school which are relevant for the world of work and which increase their opportunities for engaging in the labor market on better terms. But that wasn't actually something we were able to investigate in this study at all.
All I would add is that on the shocks and stressors, experiencing multiple shocks or combinations of shocks, series of shocks, is also something that I think quite a bit of research evidence shows is an important factor in chronic poverty. So it's not just the transitory escapes issue, it's also it's a major issue, really, for poverty reduction.
Okay, questions from in the room. Did you collect data on whether the household had an interaction with an NGO or donor-assisted project? And if so, what was the impact in terms of the project assistance? From Jennifer Bremer. We have two related questions around specialization. Was the importance of specialization based on data, or was it a hypothesis? From Josh at Food for the Hungry. And also on specialization from John Williamson at USAID, to paraphrase him just a little bit, might we be confusing cause with effect? Would you think that perhaps over time households would have many activities and then concentrate on the few that are successful of those, dropping off the ones that were less, and that the households that didn't reduce the number of economic activities failed to find any that were significantly more successful?
If I start with the interaction with NGOs or with kind of other forms of assistance. So in terms of the quantitative data, this got a bit tricky to look into. With the quantitative data, there's also the potential likelihood that people or households are receiving NGO assistance, say, because they were worse off in the first place. So it's difficult to make that link between being less or more likely to experience a sustained escape relative to the reason why you were initially selected into that program. So from the quantitative data, there wasn't really any significant kind of easily interpreted results related to NGO engagement and or receipt of government social protection transfers and escape from poverty. In terms of the qualitative, there were positive stories of engagement with NGOs, whether it was with the Feed the Future and the kind of group marketing and things which were happening in the community or in neighbouring communities. It's quite a complicated kind of thing to disentangle, I guess. In Bangladesh, credit came up a lot, engagement with credit delivering NGOs, which was either positive or negative, depending on whether the credit had been taken for productive investments or if the credit had actually been taken for consumption purposes, which tended to leave you in a cycle of taking a loan to repay another loan. Don't know if there's anything better to add there. I'll let Andrew answer on specialization, actually.
I think the specialization issue is something that we need to look further at. Mm-hmm. We were talking yesterday about whether we could perhaps pin this down in terms of numbers, because it's something that I think everybody is very interested in. And it could be that what the questioner is suggesting is correct. But it could also be that there are, also implications of specializing which contribute to the sustained escape. So I think it's something that we need to try and nail down a bit. Yep. Going ahead.
Two quick questions from online. The first one is from Stephen Angudubu. What is the contribution of crop insurance, specifically in Uganda? I think a crop insurance question came up earlier as well, and I'm not sure that we got to it. I know we talked about health insurance, but so there's another question on crop insurance. And then we have another question from Siyuki Ramadi. Did the study include local wisdom as an attribute, both respect to coping and dealing with shock?
I would observe that there are lots of questions about specific interventions, whether it's contraception or crop insurance or whatever. And it may be that these surveys that we've been using are not specifically designed to answer those questions. So quite often you'll find us saying, well, actually, we haven't particularly got any findings on that issue. I think that would apply to crop insurance, certainly, wouldn't it? It probably applies to contraception. I don't think any of the surveys that we've used have asked specific questions about access to contraception, or am I wrong there?
As from what I recall, you're not wrong. But again, yeah, some surveys, like MIX, tend to ask questions more on that, but in the surveys we've looked at, there hasn't been direct targeting of those.
So we would need, you know, if one was doing an evaluation of these issues, you'd need to probably use multiple sources, multiple data sources. But I mean, one thing that we might do is to accumulate these kind of questions as we go around presenting this work. And, you know, this can lead to a second round of analysis at some point.
Get back to questions from in the room. A couple on health. What about health, nutrition, and access to health care? Did you look at sustained escapes and presence of chronic disease, such as HIV, for example? And another health question from Kathy Savino at USAID. In looking at the health risks, were issues of household mental health at all significant? And then we had two regarding time period. The number of instances of falling back into poverty naturally depends on your period of study. When investigating sustainable poverty escapes in our own work, do you have any guidance on time periods to consider? And from John Kurtz at Mercy Corps, what time period during the panel were resilience capacities taken from? Did this allow for the lag time likely needed to see effects on poverty escape?
In terms of time periods to consider, there's no hard and fast rule for this. It's a part of the times you're restricted by what the survey data tells you as well. So, for example, is it a three-period interval between survey waves? Is it sometimes even one year on year or so on? So, ultimately, I haven't come across many cities which look at periods shorter than a year, but in general, in our case studies, it's varied from a year to around 6 years even between survey waves. We also have a methods document which outlines this in a bit more detail as well, which is, I believe, on the Microlinks website.
I think that in some cases, I know the World Bank has been supporting annual surveys in a number of countries over the last few years. And I think what you find then is that you accumulate a huge amount of data which nobody analyzes. And you run into all sorts of problems if you try and repeat your surveys too quickly. I mean, I would have said that as a rule of thumb, having a period of at least 3 years between, if you want to track changes in outcomes, having a period of at least 3 years between surveys is probably no bad thing, and that also gives you a chance to analyze the first survey before you're embroiled in the second survey. I think looking at outcome changes over shorter periods of a sort of poverty nature, if you like, or household well-being nature, doesn't really make sense. But then you do have the problem, of course, that many years are exceptional years, and it becomes very difficult if it's an exceptional year, it becomes very difficult to match that with the previous year that you've surveyed. So there are lots of great difficulties in doing this sort of longitudinal quantitative research. I didn't quite get the question about resilience. Did you get the question about resilience and time periods? Is the question how long a time period?
What time period during the panel were resilience capacities taken from?
So in the sense that, so across the different countries, the survey period itself varied. So in Bangladesh, this ranged from 1997 to 2010. In Uganda, from 2005 to 2011. And in Ethiopia, from 1997 to 2009. And in terms of the variables, so for example, shocks and all, this was aggregated for all the years in which survey data was available.
And on the other question about mental health issues, it's not something that we particularly looked at in this study, but we have been doing some other work in Bangladesh, again, combining analysis of panel data with life histories. And there we've actually worked with a much larger subsample of life histories. And mental health issues come up. I mean, again, it's quite difficult because in the quantitative data, it's really hard to distinguish mental health issues. But in the qualitative data, mental health comes out as a very, very strong contributor to many downward trajectories. And it relates a little bit to what I was saying earlier about, for example, alcoholism and domestic violence. I mean, these are the kind of things that you really need good qualitative information to track the impact of. But certainly mental health in the Bangladesh context, and I suspect from earlier work that we did in the Chronic Poverty Research Center in Uganda, it can be intimately bound up with downward trajectories and with chronic poverty.
And the last one was any findings in regard to presence of chronic disease, such as HIV?
Unless it was picked up under disability, I guess that would be what I think.
No, not at the moment. We didn't investigate that specifically, and it didn't come out in the life histories.
No.
But again, from our work on disability in Bangladesh, in fact, we began to question the international definitions of disability because the effects of chronic disease in terms of poverty and well-being trajectories could be as great as having a physical impairment or a mental health problem. So I think chronic disease, chronic illness is again a very strong factor. And I think this discussion illustrates the way that there are so many risk factors facing people who are either poor or vulnerable to poverty, and which leads you on to the need for a suite of portfolio approach to managing those risk factors.
We have a question from online from Emmanuel Osen. He thanks the panel and also wants to know whether the qualitative work illuminated any sort of findings around the influence of cultural norms with respect to risk or resilience.
Well, I mean, I think as mentioned on the slides, it was just also around the female-specific barriers that oftentimes emerge. So, for example, a lot of families withdrawing their children from primary education because withdrawing their daughters from primary education because it was considered a waste of resources, or they didn't have sufficient resources to expend to continue educating their daughters. That was one of the instances, which was tied into norms.
Yeah, I guess kind of things around risk aversion, which aren't necessarily cultural norms, if you like, but risk averse behavior in anticipation of, say, an environmental shock, or in anticipation that you're going to have to hold some money aside in order to be able to marry your daughter in the future. They would be kind of instances which came out in the life histories.
And I think perhaps, it didn't maybe come out particularly strongly in this research, but I think from the story of Bangladesh, and maybe this is something we'll come back to in the second panel, we know that the ability of women to go out in public and join groups and get migrate and get employment and so on is absolutely critical, and that's very much a factor in the sustained escapes from poverty of many households in Bangladesh. So changes in norms can also be very beneficial, and of course can be quite fragile too.
Okay, questions from in the room related to what you were just saying. From Justin Fugel, it's very interesting to see the higher level of sustained escape in Bangladesh. What made that possible? He had a second question about policy and program implications, but the next panel will get at that. Did the study touch on issues of social capital, people's level of trust in family members, neighbors, community leaders? From Kevin at World Vision. And what were the impacts of women's land ownership in poverty reduction?
I think the first one, there are probably other people better placed to talk about the successes in Bangladesh in the room. And I think Saeed Hashemi is going to be on the panel in the second session. I guess it has to do with, I think the employment in the garments industry was mentioned as a factor. It has partly to do with that and the way that that has been sustained over years. Financial services, and access to financial services, I think is at a very different level to either Uganda or Ethiopia. I think probably the women's empowerment, economic empowerment, related to those two points may be part of the story. Do you want to contribute any other factors? I think perhaps also just the Bangladesh's excellent record in controlling for at least some of the shocks, and in particular flooding, and the very successful disaster management and relief programs in Bangladesh. I mean, we could probably go on with a longer list, but those are some of the factors, I guess.
Yeah, and I think also alongside increasing agricultural wages and a growth of the rural non-farm economy, there's a lot more opportunities, I guess, within Bangladesh to sustain your escapes than, say, in Ethiopia and Uganda, potentially.
Yeah. So it's no magic bullet, but it's a composite of factors.
I mean, just drawing on the social capital question. So that's something which did come out in the life histories, particularly how you can manage and cope in response to your ex post different shocks. Being able to, say, take loans of food, shop loans, access to that type of coping strategy on better terms than those people who don't have that social capital. Again, migration is linked as well with, say, knowing somebody at the other end who says, oh, there's jobs going here if you want to come to Kampala. So social capital, I think, is social networks that are inherently built in a lot of both the coping strategies and also the more positive strategies and stories of sustained escapes as well.
Women's land ownership.
I think women's land ownership might be another one that's beyond what this study was able to look into, sadly.
Okay, a couple more questions from in the room. To what extent were the effects of climate change reflected in shocks and stressors or in coping responses? From John Williamson, USAID. Was there any indication of the importance of access or availability of information, such as climate or market information, to sustainable escape? From Josh at Food for the Hungry. And can a household living below the poverty line ever be considered resilient? Or are the two ideas by definition the same?
I think the last one is a little bit philosophical, but my intuitive answer to that would be probably not. I think, and here I guess you also need to fall back on a bit of discussion about language. What do people mean by resilient? In work that we did in Tanzania, qualitative, again, life history work, we used the participatory approach to defining different levels of well-being. And as I remember it, the out of six levels that seemed to work in most communities in Tanzania, the fifth one was the resilient level. And that was based on people's discussions in focus group discussions and so on. So and then if you tried to correlate those levels of well-being with the poverty line, the Tanzanian poverty line was roughly speaking between the third and the fourth levels. So resilience in that context seemed to be significantly above the poverty line, at least in the consideration of community members that we worked with. And that was across quite a large number of, for a qualitative piece of work, across quite a large number of communities. So I would intuitively say no to that one, but I don't know.
And a slightly tangential note, I guess, as well, is across countries. So, for example, the Ugandan national poverty line is often compared to an extreme or lower poverty line when you compare it to other country contexts. So then it's also worth keeping that in mind. So, for example, if you look at other neighboring countries, their poverty line might be higher. So in that sense, if you would compare that to the Ugandan context, they might, by definition, then be above the poverty line in Uganda, but not necessarily in another country, depending on where the poverty line has been set.
Mm-hmm. And looking to defining poverty as
exactly. And that's where the whole multidimensional work as well has been coming in now. In terms of climate change, I guess, we didn't look at the effect of climate change. That's also something that wasn't
descriptively covered in the surveys. However, it was one of the responses in the shock module that did emerge. So, for example, has the household experienced a drought or regular floods or rain and so on? And so that was captured in the shocks variable.
Yeah, and I think the best, just following up on that point, I think the best we could get out of the qualitative wasn't necessarily around climate change, but more around shifting seasons, increasing variability, less kind of understanding of when the rains might come, which that did emerge, not necessarily as a driver of transitory escapes, but something that was really, you know, worrying people. They were changing their kind of normal behaviors, if you like. Access to information. It's a really interesting question. In the qualitative, that wasn't something we analyzed in the quantitative surveys. I'm not sure if the appropriate questions were there. In terms of the qualitative, the idea Andrew was raising about these market-oriented farmers being a real kind of more likely to sustain their escapes, they weren't necessarily getting information from kind of formal sources. It was more they were quite mobile individuals. They were going to the market, getting a sense of kind of what was going on, what was selling for a high price, looking at what farmers in neighboring districts whose maybe seasonal calendar was slightly ahead of where they were living. So it wasn't necessarily formal access to information. It was more kind of gaining market intelligence around prices, I guess, which emerged as important.
We have a series of questions from our online participants that all have to do with different flavors of the influence of government and policies. So one, did you kind of find anything around government policy and how that affects the trends that emerged? Do you know of whether any government ministries are tracking this type of information? And if so, is that disaggregated by gendered household type? And another version of the question is how are governments, local, national, regional, supporting citizens through these types of shocks?
Well, we will come on to some of these issues in the second panel. I think it's an interesting one about whether government ministries are tracking this sort of information. I think a lot more could be done in many countries on that score. But I think you know, countries are in a better position now with data, at least. More regular national surveys are being done. Some of these surveys are panel surveys. There's probably twice the number of countries that have panel surveys now as had them 10 years ago. So I think there is more data available. Hopefully that data will be analyzed and well used. I think one of the programs that we have some reflection on in the studies is the Ethiopian Productive Safety Nets program. One of the things about this sort of study is that, you know, it's not designed in most cases to capture specific programs. So you might not have an adequate sample of people within the survey that have benefited from a program or have had some involvement with the program. But in Ethiopia, I think, was that the case in the quantitative work?
Yes.
But it did, the PSNP did feature, didn't it?
Yes, so they had the public
and
works.
Certainly in
component.
The qualitative work, so we were able to do some analysis of that. And I think the conclusion coming from that was that it was a little bit tentative, and I think it needs more work and, you know, probably using multiple data sources in Ethiopia, is that the kinds of shocks and stressors that vulnerable households in Ethiopia are experiencing suggest that what the PSNP is able to do is good, but is not enough. It's not adequate to the challenge. And I think it may particularly, I mean, there are different aspects to this. It doesn't cover all areas in Ethiopia, although it has been expanding. There seem to be incentives built into the program to for people to be discontinued from the program, perhaps slightly arbitrarily, without really having achieved that level of resilience that you might hope for, and so on and so forth. So I think there are some reflections on the PSNP in there. Any other government programs stand out?
I guess education, just the
expansion. Education services, health services, and agricultural programs. And you mentioned Feed the Future here and there, for example. I mean, I think the districts for the qualitative work were partly selected because they were Feed the Future. Some of them were Feed the Future districts. So did anything stand out there?
Beyond Feed the Future. Not in terms of government agricultural programs so much.
Okay, I mean, you know, again, these are questions that we can perhaps go back to the data with and have a look at, a second look at.
Okay, thank you. With that, we're going to close this panel out and go to our break. For those that are here with us in the room, if you don't know, the restroom is down the hall to the left, through the double doors and then on your right. And you found a survey on your chair. If you can please go ahead and fill that out. You can, at the end, either leave it on your chair at the end of the second panel, or you can leave it at the sign-in table as well. And we will commence the second panel at 11:15. Thank you.